7 and she's never called me.
Is that right?
The wheels were turning.
When was the last time she talked to you? Trump asked.
I thought about it.
I don't know. I guess it's probably been 5-6 months since she had a press conference.
Silence. The wheels turned some more.
You know why? Trump said.
I wanted to say, yes, Mr. Trump, because she hates us and thinks we have big egos and tiny brains. But I'd already said too much.
She doesn't have the stamina, Trump said.
He raised his voice. It takes stamina to talk to the press. I don't know if I gave Trump the idea or he'd had it for weeks. But after that, he started to tell crowds,
so it's been 235 days since Crooked Hillary has had a press conference.
His campaign started to blast out a daily reminder. Hillary hiding watch, day 262 since last press conference. Chapter 40, Off the Record, Until Hacked. Philadelphia, July 2016. An oppressive heat wave settled on Philadelphia the week of the Democratic National Convention. The city wasn't baking like South Texas, where the temperatures climb to over 100 and sit stubbornly on top of strip mall parking lots. But the air was thick and soupy. Even the breeze that came in before a downpour carried an ominous combustibility. Russians had hacked into the Democratic National Committee emails. The bros continued with their death threats. They jumped on an email exchange in which a DNC press aide said I was kind of friendly with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who resigned over the hack. The bros took this as clear evidence I was colluding with the chairwoman to elect HRC, texting me short and sweet messages like, you Hillary-loving cunt. My emails to the DNC were nothing. Mostly Debbie and I talked about dieting, workouts, and dealing with our unruly Jufros. Not exactly the makings for a grand conspiracy. But Times reporters, Democratic leaders, donors, Brooklyn aides, hell, even campaign volunteers were panicked. Could our emails be next? Sources got so nervous, at least two of them started to text me, OTR, until hacked. Ever since the State Department, Hillary had a thing about Putin and vice versa. Months before she declared her candidacy, at a paid speech in Winnipeg, she'd broken into an impersonation of Putin. Without being asked about the Russian leader, she put on a deep-accented voice and swayed her head left and right, pretending to be Putin having a conversation with himself.
Vladimir, you think you'd like to be president again?
Now, as she tried to woo Republicans, Hillary sounded positively Reagan-esque as she criticized Trump's Russophilia.
He praises dictators like Vladimir Putin and picks fights with our friends, she said the previous month. Putin will eat your lunch.
In May, she said a Trump presidency would be like Christmas in the Kremlin. But the evidence that Russian intelligence had been behind the 20,000 stolen DNC emails released at precisely the right time to disrupt the convention handed Brooklyn a good versus evil plot out of a Le Carré novel. There have been larger forces at work to hurt Hillary Clinton, Robbie said in the opening hours of the convention. I wrapped all this Russian intrigue into a seamy blog post casting Trump as a Manchurian candidate, Putin's unwitting puppet. I liked the story, but I also saw the wisdom when my editors deemed it was too unsupported to publish.
God forbid they make one dick soft in a swing state.
Linda Bloodworth Thomason talked as you'd expect the creator of Designing Women to talk. She was particularly saucy the second morning of the convention. She'd been fighting with Brooklyn over a biographical video she and her husband, Harry Thomason, made that was supposed to introduce Hillary that evening. At the 1992 convention, the Thomasons, Hollywood filmmakers and writers who have been friends with the Clintons since the 1970s, wove Bill's Hard Knocks childhood into the greatest origin story of modern politics with the Man from Hope video. Some people think that Bill must have been born wealthy and raised wealthy, Hillary says while sitting on a patio in pink shoulder pads. Insert Dickensian images of his childhood in rural Arkansas here.
Well, you know, instead of being born with a silver spoon in his mouth, he was really born in a house with an outhouse in the backyard. The Thomasons wanted to pull off the same feat for Hillary, but her origin story, a nuclear family in an upper-middle-class Chicago suburb and Wellesley education, didn't exactly give them the same artistic tableau. They needed to go one generation back to Hillary's mother, Dorothy, abandoned by her parents at 8 years old, on her own, and working as a housekeeper for $3 a week at 14, before raising the little girl who was one election away from becoming the FWP. The Thomasons enlisted Meryl Streep to narrate. Her name, like another little girl who got caught up in her own history-making tornado, was Dorothy, Streep said. The footage then moved on to the women who came before Hillary, Harriet Tubman, Susan B. Anthony, Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosa Parks, and Sally Ride. It ended on a 2010 photo of Dorothy, Hillary, and Chelsea at Chelsea's wedding. On my second day in Philly, I sat in a cracked leather armchair in the lobby of the Hilton Garden Inn to download the 10-minute video. It gave me the chills. The video, called Shoulders, was the first time so far at a convention designed to celebrate Hillary when I actually felt moved by her arc. Not the one created for her by pollsters and strategists, but the real one, rooted in a daughter's love for her mother. I know that sounds cheesy, but Meryl was narrating. Ad man Jim Margolis, Joel, and Mandy took one look and killed it. The plan had been to not overplay the history-making part. Hillary did that already in the Brooklyn Navy Yard speech and in the Where Are All the Men introductory video. Now she needed to broaden her appeal and reach Republicans and men. Brooklyn decided Hillary would promise to break down all barriers. For Christ's sake, no glass ceilings. Press will immediately go to this as a more narrow attempt to appeal to women, Joel said when the ceilings language had crept back into a speech during the primaries. Podesta agreed. Ceilings language is catnip for press and will drown out breakdown barriers. Like a lot of Hillary's female friends, Linda worried the campaign could have been slicing and dicing the data needed to sell any Democratic nominee. The newer aides didn't know Hillary and didn't really care to. She was a blank slate on which to project a rainbow coalition of Obama voters. Dorothy is the only poetry she's got, Linda said. The campaign went instead with a biographical video from Shonda Rhimes, the scandal creator. All roads lead back to Tony Goldwyn. On the final night of the festivities, the video would show scenes of Hillary when she was a New York senator, comforting first responders after the September 11th terrorist attacks and imploring George W. Bush in the Oval Office for $20 billion to rebuild New York. In this version of her story, Hillary sits in a sunny kitchen in front of a vase of fresh flowers and a stack of cookbooks. Wink, wink, women. As Morgan Freeman's languid narration explains how she almost single-handedly captured and killed Osama bin Laden. Look at her face, Freeman says of the photo of Hillary in the Situation Room, holding a hand to her mouth and surrounded by men, paralyzed, their eyes fixed to a screen, showing images of a Navy SEAL raid on a compound in Pakistan. She's carrying the hope and the rage of an entire nation. In 2011, Hillary attributed her expression in the photo to her pollen allergies, but I guess the hope and rage of an entire nation sounded better. I walked past the Ritz-Carlton near Center Square, where black SUVs lined up outside to drop off wealthy donors. They wore a rainbow of credentials and VIP passes around their necks. Protesters yelled into bullhorns, and each time the bellmen opened the door and welcomed guests into the Ritz cool marble lobby under the calming hum of classical music, protesters' chants of, "Hell no, DNC! And we won't vote for Hillary! And WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks!" would blow in with the soup and retreat again as the doors swung shut. "This is what democracy looks like," a protester with dreadlocks and Clearasil perfect skin yelled from a bullhorn. A security guard pushed along two young girls who wore T-shirts that said, "I'm not a super predator." The sun beat down on the cement and the police stood in clusters trying to find shade.
Chapter 41. The Red Scare. Philadelphia, July, 2016.
I saw Deborah Messing downstairs earlier, a woman with Prada sneakers said to no one in particular as the elevator doors closed. The blue-lit lobby of the Le Méridien had leather benches and a sleek silver bar where a couple of donors sipped mimosas before stepping out into the soup.
"Can you hit 6 for me?" the woman said.
When the elevators opened again, Bryan Cranston got off. This is what democracy looks like. The press took our seats in a ballroom at the Le Méridien for a Bloomberg politics breakfast with John Podesta. I walked the length of the rectangular table twice, passing name tags of journalists who didn't need any introduction. Andrea Mitchell, John Heilman, Susan Page. Before I remembered, Jonathan had RSVP'd for the breakfast and then given the invite to me. I pulled out the chair behind Jonathan Martin, The New York Times. Podesta sat in the center, hoisting his head left and right as the reporters yelled, "John over here, and John to your left." "John, tell us a little bit first about last night, about, I think it's safe to say, 8:30, there was a lot of tension on that floor." "John, are there still more disruptions, more booing, more anger today?" "John, what if there's a walkout? What if there's a big protest? How would you deal with that?"
"Everybody is going to get a chance to vote, and then she is going to make history," Podesta replied.
"Next question." When the talk started to lag, I saw an opening. The Russians hadn't come up. The Bernie bros seemed the more imminent threat. The Russian meddling subplot still seemed far-fetched. Even Nancy Pelosi, when asked if the Trump campaign could have played any role in the release of the 20,000 DNC emails, said, "I have no reason to think that." Hillary's aides pushed that the Russians were helping Trump, but always in hushed, off-the-record winks and nods, like they didn't really believe it, but wanted it to be true because it would help Hillary. "He certainly has a kind of bromance going on with Mr. Putin, so I don't know," Podesta said. When the Washington Post's Phil Rucker asked Robbie if he was concerned about threats Julian Assange had made about future hacked emails that WikiLeaks would release to inflict damage on Hillary and the campaign, Robbie replied, "I'm not going to put a lot of stock into what Julian Assange says. I mean, he says a lot of things, and so I'm not going to pay attention to that." I asked Podesta, who worked extensively on cybersecurity in the Obama White House, whether his own or anyone else's in the campaign's emails may have been hacked. "We don't know the answer to that, and we feel like we have robust security within the campaign and obviously are contacting on a daily basis." "So the FBI hasn't warned you or anyone else?" I continued. He cut me off. "No, the FBI, no." His head whirled left, right. Next question, Andrea? A few days later, I saw the Yahoo News headline, "FBI warned Clinton campaign last spring of cyber attack." FBI agents had met with senior campaign officials in Brooklyn to warn them that their emails, and particularly Podesta's, may have been penetrated through so-called spear phishing emails. I never knew why Podesta hadn't been honest about that. But maybe it was because outsider Guy had been right when he told me, "No one takes you seriously." If I'd been Jonathan Martin, would Podesta have at least pulled me aside afterward to explain things? Brooklyn didn't want any more hacking news to overshadow the convention, but Trump couldn't resist urging Russian intelligence to hack into Hillary's emails. "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find those 30,000 emails that are missing," he said at a news conference in Doral, Florida. "I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press." Thing was, Trump didn't need to put on a public display. In March, around the time the FBI paid a visit to Brooklyn, Russian hackers sent a phishing email to Podesta's personal Gmail account. He opened the link and clicked on the Change Password button. Chapter 42. Gladiator Arena. Philadelphia, July, 2016. While Trump had emerged as a fog-enshrouded silhouette at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Hillary, a reluctant star in the 4-day infomercial of her life's work, had watched most of her convention at home on TV. She didn't arrive in Philly until Wednesday and didn't appear on stage until the third night, and only for a second to give Obama a warm, primetime hug. "She's an introvert," Tom Vilsack, the agriculture secretary, told me. "The spotlight is pretty glaring, and she likes to deflect from it." Brooklyn worried, too, that the hagiography of a political convention would only add to the perception that Hillary is all about herself. They made behind-the-scenes efforts to revise "I'm with her" to the less self-centered "she's with us." Hillary had no problem with conventions when she played a supporting role. In 1992, she'd waved and exhaled, clutching Chelsea's hand tight, a tinge of relief and anticipation and a what-now look on her face as the confetti blanketed Madison Square Garden moments after Bill, still doughy and cherub-cheeked, spoke of the new covenant and a country of boundless hopes and endless dreams. A far cry from the 2016 message, "Vote Hillary, the other guy is a sociopath." She'd hardly finished delivering her nomination acceptance address when everyone agreed that the speech had been serviceable. Editors and reporters nodded that she did what she needed to do. She hadn't blown anyone away, but she just needed to not be Trump. A month earlier, Hillary, who'd begun jotting down what she wanted to say after the New York primary in April, sat down with policy guy and speechwriters Dan and Megan. Dan had heavy brows and a neat beard that ran directly into his head of brown curls. In addition to being Hillary's chief speechwriter, he was best bros with brown loafers, which protected his position even as outsiders constantly grumbled that Hillary's speeches had become a blur of bromides. If Hillary wasn't promising to build ladders of opportunity, she was vowing to reshuffle the deck and to make sure every child can live up to his or her God-given potential. I didn't envy Dan. I had 3, maybe 4 editors read my big stories. He had to collect and entertain opinions from an apparatus as ungainly and hierarchical as the Clinton campaign, plus family, and somehow weave it all into a salient speech. Dan's emails often included feedback like "big revision from WJC," or Podesta's critique that an early draft has the feel of the kitchen sink being thrown in. Joel provided the constructive, "for what it's worth, I hate the yelling, screaming Trump graph. It sounds completely contrived and doesn't deliver a big joke or a big point." Then there were the findings of focus groups, like, "let's make sure we don't go too far with the anti-corporate rhetoric despite the anger we heard in yesterday's groups in Detroit." I imagined an elderly woman behind two-way glass at an office park in Greater Miami reaching for the chicken chow mein and explaining to JFK speechwriter Ted Sorensen that "ask not what your country can do for you" line just seems so bossy. Dan's position as the chief speechwriter irritated some of Hillary's aides, who projected onto the Andover grad all their frustrations that crafty men always seem to upstage more talented, low-key women, namely Megan. Dan had already started to think about Hillary's inauguration speech and would talk about how he'd structure his White House speechwriting team with everything, national security, domestic agenda, etc., reporting to him. Lissa Muscatine, the warm co-owner of the Politics and Prose bookstore in Washington, who had written speeches for Hillary since the White House years and knew her and her voice better than any of the younger generation of writers, pitched in, as did Jon Favreau, Obama's star speechwriter. The guys hated it when we gave Favreau credit for a Hillary speech. Favs brought out all their insecurities about 2008 and the Obama white boys. Yes, in 2008, John had posed groping the right breast of a cardboard cutout of Hillary. But mostly John's involvement undermined Dan, who considered himself the new Favreau. Dan and Megan and Policy Guy ordered room service in a deluxe king suite at the Logan Hotel and worked until 4, the final morning of the convention. In a backstage locker room, Hillary scratched last-minute changes to the final draft right until she walked on stage. In a white Ralph Lauren pantsuit and crew-neck shirt underneath, she looked resplendent. Seeing Hillary take the stage as the Democratic Party's nominee, the waving white solo speck at the center of a circumference of 50 stars, made all the complicated feelings I had about her briefly fall away. She warned of a moment of reckoning, referenced great presidents past, both Republican and Democrat. He's taken the Republican Party a long way from mourning in America, and the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. She scattered in some self-deprecation. It's true, I sweat the details of policy. And she recited some resume points. I went to 112 countries, in the White House Situation Room, and I wrote a book called It Takes a Village. The press started to file out of the arena, leaving the Times row of assigned seats littered with empty Pepsi cans, tangy crumbs from a family-sized bag of Cheetos, and the wrapper from a frosted Pop-Tart. The intensity of covering the convention had caused us all to revert back to eating like 10-year-olds reared in 1980s suburbia. I stayed behind and kept my eyes fixed on the stage. I remember feeling delight as I watched Hillary. She looked childlike, staring up with an oblong mouth and the bulbous, happy eyes of an anime character, as the red, white, and blue balloons and a deluge of patriotic confetti showered around her. I saw her kick a red balloon with her kitten heel and catch an oversized blue one with white stars in her arms, hugging it tight as if her knight had been oxygen trapped inside its latex belly. It was after midnight when Pat Healy and I closed our story. Carolyn, putting an end to 2 weeks straight of convention coverage, picked up one of the half dozen cans of Diet Coke and, noticing that it was empty, dropped it and picked up another. She stared at our story on her screen in its 64-point font as Very Senior Editor looked over her shoulder. When she finally hit send, dispersing our copy to printing plants nationwide, I packed up my temporary desk, including all my chargers and notebooks. The newspaper that next morning was a thing of beauty. The headline, Clinton warns of moment of reckoning, accepts historic nomination promising to rebuild bonds of trust, stretched across all six columns. I stared at my name in print under Pat's and next to a photo of Hillary waving to the convention crowd. Philadelphia. Hillary Diane Rodham Clinton, who sacrificed personal ambition for her husband's political career and then rose to be a globally influential figure, became the first woman to accept a major party's presidential nomination on Thursday night. I'd thrown my elbows around enough by then that I wrote or co-wrote front-page stories several times a week, but this one was different. I held the paper in my hands, staring at my oddly Slavic surname, the name passed to me from the shtetls of Poland and the Lower East Side to my traveling salesman grandpa in Waco. The name I just couldn't change when I married an Irishman. I envisioned mothers reading our lead to daughters, historians referring back to our words. I'd been on the beat for so long that it hadn't occurred to me that there would be a time when Hillary would no longer be running for president. With the conventions behind us, everyone started to think about what they'd do next. This added another layer to our already competitive politics pod. I had colleagues like Jonathan Martin who were born to cover politics. A couple of years back when I told Jonathan I was in Texas for my grandpa's funeral and that he was almost 101, Jonathan wrote back immediately, "Wow, born in the Taft administration." I told him he could own any beat. "Nah," Jonathan replied, "I'm like a podiatrist. I just do toes." But I'd become a campaign reporter not because of my love for politics or my encyclopedic knowledge, but because my career had, from an early age, become intertwined with Hillary's. Now I couldn't imagine a future separate from hers. I didn't really want to move to Washington, but I needed to be there for the final act, covering Hillary as the FWP. So I know I was wavering on D.C. the last time we talked, but I really would love to cover the White House if Hillary wins, I told Very Senior Editor over coffee that morning. He crumpled his eyebrows behind his wire-rimmed glasses. "Would you move to Washington?" he asked. I nodded, hoping to convey that I would do anything for the Times. "Absolutely," I said. Bobby never said so, but I knew he would have preferred that my next posting take us to Hong Kong or Delhi, somewhere far away from the Clintons, and that reminded us of the adventures we'd had in Japan. But he knew me well enough to know that I wouldn't be able to let Hillary go if she became the FWP. In the past few weeks, he started to peruse job listings in D.C. and signed us up for Trulia updates, fixer-uppers in Georgetown mostly. Well, that would make sense, very senior editor said. He was supportive, but noncommittal. Maybe I wanted my editors to want me for the White House job more than I actually wanted the job. Several years back, I'd let one of the Iraq war vets who taught my boot camp talk me into signing up for something called a Spartan super race. This included an 8-mile run over sand and mud, crawling under barbed wire, and jumping over fire. When I arrived in Staten Island to register, I looked around and saw brawny, shirtless men in military fatigues writing their race numbers on their foreheads with permanent marker. I knew I wasn't cut out to be a Spartan when I inquired whether this numerical system would make my skin break out. 5 hours later, when I got to the grand finale, a gladiator arena where race organizers in leather loincloths pummel contestants with pugil sticks, I didn't feel like a badass Spartan queen. I felt really fucking stupid for signing up in the first place. The White House job would have been gladiator arena. 4 more years of fighting with the guys. 4 more years of fighting to write the same stories as the rest of the pack. 4 more years of waiting for a press aide to tell me, off the record and for planning purposes only, that I needed to arrive by 7 a.m. so that I could sit in a press van. But I had some masochistic urge to do it anyway. After all, I'd jump through fire, or at least being fired, to get there. Condé Nast had done away with the Rover program a long time ago, but part of me was still the interloper staring at the back of David Remnick's head in the elevator. I still needed to prove something. Christina, one of my few friends who can get away with passing off unsolicited life advice picked up from her therapist and self-help books, diagnosed me as suffering from striveritis. After the last balloon had dropped, Hillary spent at least an hour backstage, exchanging air kisses and pleasantries with Meryl Streep, Katy Perry, and other assorted VIPs before she went back to the Logan Hotel and sipped champagne with friends. Trump had entered the third day of his feud with the grief-stricken Muslim parents of Humayun Khan, an army officer killed in the Iraq War, and a lot of Hillary's friends saw an opening. Now's your chance, Hillary, to get out and show people who you really are. They'll love you like we love you, one girlfriend told Hillary backstage. But Hillary was done trying. A week earlier, she cut off Joel and the pollster John Anzalone as they walked her through the almost daily reminder that half the country disliked her. You know, I'm getting pretty tired of hearing about how nobody likes me, she said. Oh, what's the point? They're never going to like me, Hillary told this friend. I thought of something Bill had told me in Uganda, how Hillary had laughed when they were dating at Yale and he suggested she run for office. Look at how hard-hitting I am, she'd told him. Nobody will ever vote for me for anything. After the Philly rally, Hillary, Bill, Kane, and his wife Ann Holton would embark on a 3-day jobs tour across an industrial swath of Pennsylvania and Ohio. Brooklyn thought Trump's meltdown with the Khans and all the independents and military men who spoke at the convention could give Hillary an opening with Romney voters. I'm also going to pay special attention to those parts of the country that have been left out and left behind, Hillary had said in her Philly speech. From our inner cities to our small towns, from Indian country to coal country, from communities ravaged by addiction and places hollowed out by plant closures. Anybody willing to work in America should be able to find a job and get ahead and stay ahead. That's my goal. But after the bus tour, Hillary spent most of August hobnobbing with the ultra-wealthy. She hauled in $143 million that month, including $50 million at 22 fundraisers in the last 2 weeks of August. After months of trying to portray Trump as the embodiment of a system where the rich and powerful stick it to everybody else, Hillary closed out the summer by averaging $150,000 an hour. Chapter 43. HRC has no public events scheduled. The Hamptons, August 2016. Hillary always broke down Trump supporters into 3 baskets. Basket number 1, the Republicans who hated her and would vote Republican no matter who the nominee. Basket number two, voters whose jobs and livelihoods had disappeared, or as Hillary said, who feel that the government has let them down, the economy has let them down, nobody cares about them, nobody worries about what happens to their lives and their futures. Basket number three, the deplorables. This basket includes the racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. The deplorables always got a laugh over living room chats in the Hamptons, at dinner parties under the stars on Martha's Vineyard, over past hors d'oeuvres in Beverly Hills, and during sunset cocktails in Silicon Valley. As Hillary was breaking down the baskets to donors, Trump spent August as if anticipating this gaffe gift basket. He told a crowd in Manchester that Hillary lies and she smears and she paints decent Americans, you, as racists. I'll pause here to add a subcategory to Brown Loafer's gaffe matrix. The damning statements that aides see coming but don't have the cojones to stop. In 2008, Michelle Obama's team grimaced every time she said, "For the first time in my adult life, I am really proud of my country," at dozens of private fundraisers before she blurted it out at a Milwaukee rally and handed the GOP an attack on the Obama's patriotism more potent than any flag pin. Mitt Romney didn't start talking about the 47% that night in Boca Raton. The guys and other senior aides who heard Hillary talk about the baskets could have warned her that the whole deplorable thing wouldn't look so good if it got out. But Hillary liked the line. Who was going to tell her to stop? The travelers weren't allowed to cover Hillary's fundraisers. This made her comfortable testing out new lines in the safe haven of friends willing to pay $10,000 plus. We traced the origins of a general election favorite, friends don't let friends vote for Trump, to Hillary's LGBT fundraiser with Cher in Provincetown. I stand between you and the apocalypse, a line that Hillary used in interviews throughout the fall and then ended up a headline in the New York Times Magazine cover story, started in the backyard of Jimmy Buffett's beachside estate. Calvin Klein, Harvey Weinstein, Andy Cohen, and the other guests who'd paid $100,000 to attend ate up the apocalypse line. For the Hey Jude finale, Hillary danced under a tent lined with tiki lamps alongside Buffett, John Bon Jovi, and Paul McCartney. To see Hillary dance, really dance, and not attempt the whip slash nay-nay on the Ellen DeGeneres show was worth the steep price tag. She is a collection of mismatched limbs and hip rolls, the joyous, intoxicating cavort of a rhythmless but happy woman. For months, on almost daily conference calls, Joel told Hillary that most of the country hated her. Note to self, though she professes indifference to what people think, she is actually acutely aware of opinion polling on her, Diane Blair wrote of Hillary during the White House years. In the Hamptons, Hillary felt loved. Hillary the introvert, Hillary the compassionate misanthrope, Hillary of Coke bottle glasses and hairdo changes became the belle of the ball. I stopped traveling regularly. Hillary's public schedule was scant, and while I've often surrendered my dignity for the job, yelling at Bill Clinton about emails as he visited with impoverished children comes to mind, I drew the line at sitting outside rich people's houses hoping for a glimpse of Hillary. On most days, the travelers didn't see her. Typical dispatches from the road would read, "Poole was unable to hear a word of HRC's remarks at first cocktail party. She also took questions, which Poole was also prohibited from hearing." And Poole could hear Clinton's voice but could not make out any exact words. The caretaker of a Bridgehampton compound spotted the press sitting around in the Poole house and asked when they'd go inside to see her. We told him, "No, we aren't allowed to do that." He seemed incredulous, Peter Nicholas wrote. Poole reported no sightings of Clinton the entire day. Annie Carney summed up the summer as a sensory deprivation experience. After our last interview, Hillary promised to compare our reading lists at the end of the summer. I nagged and nagged the campaign, even preemptively sending my own list, which included not one, but two self-help titles. But this never happened. Instead, Hillary chose to talk about her reading list with an 11-year-old blogger at Elle magazine. Each week, I forwarded the editors the For Planning Purposes Only guidance from Sarah, who fielded the travelers' complaints from the Brooklyn headquarters. Saturday, August 20th. HRC will attend finance events on Nantucket, Massachusetts, and on Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Sunday, August 21st. HRC will attend finance events on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Monday, August 22nd. HRC will appear on Jimmy Kimmel Live and attend finance events in Los Angeles, California. Tuesday, August 23rd. HRC will attend finance events in the Los Angeles and Orange County areas and then the Bay Area, California. Wednesday, August 24th. HRC will attend finance events in the Bay Area, California. Thursday, August 25th. HRC will campaign in the Reno, Nevada area. Friday, August 26th. HRC has no public events scheduled. Saturday, August 27th. HRC has no public events scheduled. Sunday, August 28th, Monday, August 29th, Tuesday, August 30th, HRC will attend finance events in the New York area. Wednesday, August 31st, HRC will address the American Legion's 96th National Convention in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thursday, September 1st, HRC has no public events scheduled. Friday, September 2nd, HRC has no public events scheduled. Saturday, September 3rd. HRC has no public events scheduled. Sunday, September 4th. HRC has no public events scheduled. Does she even want to be president? An editor wrote back. I had so much time in New York in late August that I started thinking about my ovaries again. In the 3 years since I'd blown off Dr. Rosenbaum's advice to have a baby and bring an au pair on the campaign trail, Bobby and I had filed the baby thing so deep in the back of our minds, you'd think I was a 17-year-old on the pill. I had no eggs on ice. We didn't talk about becoming parents or envy our friends' kids. Our 5-year plan included potentially moving to Washington, followed by the 2020 election. As the taxi sped along the East River on my way to an appointment with a new gynecologist, I looked out the window and noticed Roosevelt Island, where Hillary had delivered her milquetoast kickoff speech. The island, the bust of FDR, where it all started, taunted me. Your fertile window is closing. Dr. Broderick looked at my file. She had a moon face framed by wisps of strawberry blonde hair. You're not old, she said. I liked her. I told her about my insane work schedule, so I can't do anything at least until November, but then there will be the transition. I told her about the judgy fertility act that kept guilting me while I was on the road. She agreed with Maggie that I should delete it immediately. I said that if Bobby and I decided to really do this, it would have to be an off-cycle baby, what the female travelers said when they would time births between presidential campaigns. Dr. Broderick listened. She didn't look at me as though I was crazy, which made me seriously question what New York women in their mid-30s have confided to her. She said we'd run some tests when I had time and then said, "It's New York, Amy. Everybody who wants a baby gets a baby." In the old days, before David Geffen slept in the Lincoln bedroom, twice, before a Texas oil man and a Cincinnati trial lawyer got rides on Air Force One, and before a telecom executive and her third husband honeymooned in the White House, Democrats raised money from labor unions and East Coast liberals. Then Bill and Hillary came along and the game changed. With the help of money man Terry McAuliffe, the Clintons built a coast-to-coast network of Southern trial lawyers, Hollywood producers, Midwestern businessmen, and Wall Street executives, and they treated these donors like family. Hillary showered them with handwritten notes and birthday calls. "It's your Secretary of State calling to wish you a happy birthday." Terry once left his wife crying in the car with their newborn son so he could pop in at a fundraiser on the way home from the hospital. "I felt bad for Dorothy, but it was $1 million for the Democratic Party," he wrote. Donors ate up the personal treatment. One donor who loved the attention complained to me that Obama didn't do the same. "I could donate a kidney to Malia and not get invited to the White House," he said. Hillary was always paranoid about money. She once said she'd been worrying about her commodity trades while in labor with Chelsea. And just as leaving the White House with $5 million in legal fees drove a dead-broke Hillary to hit the Wall Street speech circuit, lending her 2008 campaign $13 million of her own money had turned Hillary in 2016 into both a cheapskate and a ravenous fundraiser. But the Clinton style of fundraising was anachronistic, especially in a Two Americas election year. Throughout the primaries, Hillary would exhaust herself dropping off the campaign trail weekly to crisscross the country and hit up a living room full of rich people for $2,700 checks. Bernie, meanwhile, had a couple of kids working his website and turned online donations of $5 or $10 into a $230 million windfall. His campaign raised $8 million in the 48 hours after winning New Hampshire, $3.6 million in the days after hashtag Bernie Sanders. Hillary relied on Dennis Chang, a sleek London School of Economics graduate who wears pocket squares and Paul Smith socks and has amassed the most impressive Rolodex in Democratic politics. He'd leveraged the pre-campaign period to build up a $250 million endowment for the Clinton Foundation, or what one former aide called Chelsea's nest egg. Dennis struck a more refined, reserved presence than the avuncular frat boy Terry, but they shared the same attentiveness. Donors described Dennis as a master concierge. He offered a full menu. For $250,000 per person, donors could have an intimate chat with Hillary at a waterfront estate in Sagaponack. For $2,700, the children, 16 and under, of donors at the Sag Harbor estate of hedge fund magnate Adam Sender, could ask Hillary a question. "I go to Dalton, but how would you make sure every kid gets to go to a good school?" asked an 8-year-old boy who in 10 years will surely be dropping the H-bomb into mid-conversation. Want a family photo with Hillary? That's an extra $10,000. I'd carved out a tabloidy mini-beat reporting on Bill and Hillary in the Hamptons, partly because any story that merged the two topics almost guaranteed me the cover of Sunday Styles. But I also had some sociological urge to understand why the area and its old money had such a hold on us transplants. Trump and the Hamptons never mixed. His is not the kind of wealth that wants to hide behind the hedges. He'd once yelled at Rupert Murdoch that he'd sue for libel after the New York Post reported that the exclusive Maidstone Club in East Hampton denied his membership. Screw him. Trump would take the gauchiness of Palm Beach instead. But Bill and Hillary were Gatsby's pursuers. I didn't believe the spin that Hillary only spent time in the Hamptons because she had to fundraise. She thought she was going to win, and she liked it there. Those were her people. At least, Hillary thought they were her people until she took their money and lost to Trump. I'll never forget sitting in the Upper East Side penthouse apartment of one of Hillary's most loyal friends and family shortly after the November election. "Look around," this friend said. I turned my head to scan the panoramic views of Manhattan, the winding marble staircase, the original Monet on the walls, the untouched crystal plate of macaroons on the table. "I'm not a loser. Hillary is a L-O-S-E-R," the friend said, making an L with one hand and holding it against the forehead. I discovered the Hamptons after Mr. Ascot at Condé Nast passed off that unwanted invitation to the Sex and the City party. But for Bobby and me, the exclusive shores of Long Island usually meant a half day of fluke fishing in Montauk and a room at Daunt's Albatross, a 1970s-era motel with a complimentary VHS library and walls so thin that we played Guess the Fake Orgasm. If the motel didn't work out, we did what Bill, Hillary, and most of New York did. We mooched off rich friends. In late August, Bill showed up with Hillary's two dogs, Maisie, a curly-haired mutt, and Tally, a toy poodle mix, to crash in Steven Spielberg's East Hampton guest house. Hillary's brothers, Tony and Hugh, and the entire extended family showed up, the moochers of the moochers. A grocer in East Hampton told me he saw Roger Clinton buying milk in a tracksuit. In 2012, the Clintons had a dispute over the security deposit of a 12,000-square-foot East Hampton mansion they rented, the one with the heated pool that typically goes for $200,000 per month in August. These details went over about as well as the Yorkie and only added to the guys not taking me seriously. But I couldn't help it. I mean, who brings their dogs? Where has Hillary Clinton been? Ask the ultra-rich. Was just about the last front-page headline that Hillary wanted splashed across the Sunday Times. She also didn't want Anthony Weiner's latest dick pic, this time with the pixelated image of his 3-year-old son Jordan in bed next to him, to appear on the cover of the New York Post. Pop goes the Weiner. Or for her 8-point post-convention lead in national polls to have evaporated to 3 points. But before Labor Day, Hillary would get all of this, plus a budding case of pneumonia. Chapter 44, Media Blame Pollen. Labor Day, 2016. Hope you're enjoying a last weekend in the Hamptons before things get crazy. Brownloafers closed his brief but effective email shaming me for the Hillary and the ultra-rich story. Westchester County Airport departure, date, Monday, September 5th, 2016. Media arrival, 6 a.m. Time, 9:30 a.m. Where, Westchester County Airport Ross Aviation West, FBO, White Plains, New York. I wished I were in the Hamptons. On the last Sunday of the summer, I was on my way to White Plains, a sturdy commuter town an hour north of the city that is the opposite of the Hamptons. We had to be at the airport near Chappaqua early the next morning to cover the most anticipated event of the campaign, at least to us. The unveiling of a squat Boeing 737 strewn with a shiny new coat of white paint, an H on its cyan blue tail, and the newly minted Stronger Together slogan splashed across its side torso. The plane had arrived. The travelers welcomed this development with the silly enthusiasm of neglected hamsters about to be handed a carrot. We took selfies in our assigned seats, piled stacks of H-branded cocktail napkins into our bags, and shot Snapchat videos of our shared quarters. "Look, there's Huma in the front of the plane," one of the travelers said. Mike, the campaign's freckled luggage handler, pulled a sheer navy blue curtain close to block off the front cabin where the staff took their seats. We hadn't seen Huma since she announced her separation post Pop Goes the Weiner. I guess that answers whether Hillary's gonna sideline her. Dude, she's never gonna sideline her. Poor Huma. After a few rounds of Whole 30 and regular workouts on the road with Annie, I'd managed to gain only a few pounds. But I remembered from 08 that the real gluttony came with the in-flight catering. When we boarded the Stronger Together Express, plates of fresh fruit and cheese, yogurt parfaits, and bottles of sparkling water sat on our downturned tray tables. For all the legends of the inebriated traveling press corps, we preferred guzzling down bottles of Perrier. We'd already been fed Dunkin' Donuts in the hangar while waiting on a team of German shepherds to sniff our luggage. But when the flight attendants came down the aisles listing the breakfast offerings, I said, "Oh, I just had a donut. I guess I'll take the omelet." We were so fat and happy on the plane that we adopted a new word, the slunch, short for the second lunch. The slunch usually arrived around 3 or 4 p.m. and often had a local theme. Lobster rolls left on our seats after a stop in Boston. Annie sat on hers. Empanadas after a rally in Miami. Barbecue on our flight out of Kansas City. I couldn't have timed my Hampton story any worse. The first day we finally shared close quarters and no one from the campaign, not even Barb, the petite photographer whom I'd been friendly with since 2008 and who went on the Africa trip in 2012, was speaking to me. I'd walked into the private jet terminal in Westchester, acting as if it were the first day of school. "Hey, how was everyone's weekend?" I said to a private airport lounge full of campaign staffers' eat-shit looks. "I just thought that story was really unfair," a young press aide said as we washed our hands and partook in the free mouthwash in the ladies' room. "What's she supposed to do, not fundraise?" The story, co-written with Jonathan Martin, was meant to be a light, airy romp explaining to readers how Hillary spent the last couple weeks of August. We filled it with vapid Yorkie details. The $100,000 per couple lamb dinner that Lady Lynn Forrester de Rothschild hosted under a tent on the lawn of her oceanfront Martha's Vineyard mansion. the 10-person chat in Sagaponack that raised $2.5 million. Hillary, sandwiched between Justin Timberlake and Jessica Biel in a photo booth set up at a $33,400 per guest lunch at the couple's Hollywood Hills home. The campaign called it snarky. The hashtag I'm with her crowd called it a hit job. I'd spent the summer mostly writing glowing stories, not because I wanted to suck up. By then, Hillary and my relationship, which had early on wavered between courtship and repulsion, had been undone. But because I wanted to give Hillary her rightful front page, above the fold, due for becoming the first woman to capture the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, standing up to Trump and pulling off a smooth, even inspiring, convention. The campaign wasn't perfect. Hillary wasn't perfect. And I got my fair share of hell for covering those flaws in real time. Much of what I got from Hillary and her supporters, I deserved. But the vast majority of my stories had nothing to do with emails or the foundation or Hillary's perceived flaws. Taken as a whole, they'd rank neutral to positive with plenty of wet kisses thrown in. Ever since the Journal, I'd been drawn to policy stories. Before the 2016 campaign even started, I wrote about Hillary working to craft an economic agenda that would address growing inequality and stagnant wages. For the next 2 years, I wrote about every one of Hillary's major policy rollouts: taxes, infrastructure, immigration, gun control, early childhood education, and others. All while knowing that these stories would go virtually unnoticed by my editors, by readers, by the campaign. And I gravitated to lengthy features about little-known chapters of Hillary's life. This was not easy to do with a presidential candidate who'd first been featured in The Times in 1969, 5 years before the paper first published the name Bill Clinton, and who remained in the public eye ever since. Tension didn't always mean negative stories. I wrote features about Hillary's tortured relationship with her sullen, unappeasable father, Hugh Rodham. About the 2 years after Bill Clinton lost re-election in the 1980 Arkansas governor's race, when it fell on Hillary to find a place for the family to live, care for 9-month-old Chelsea, and pick up extra hours at the Rose Law Firm, all while Bill cheated and sulked, playing I Don't Know Whether to Kill Myself or Go Bowling on the jukebox. I wrote about Hillary as a fish-out-of-water litigator trying cases in Arkansas, including defending a pawn shop bouncer named Tiny, because he was anything but, who stood accused of beating up his girlfriend, and a crop duster who flew his plane too close to the fields and injured a farm worker. I thought of this as explanatory journalism, and that my features would help Americans see this enigma of a public figure as a daughter, a young activist, a jobbing lawyer, and a working mother stressed about her family's finances. These pieces required digging through documents in Arkansas, a welcome change from the packed journalism of the bus, and almost always humanized Hillary in ways her campaign often failed to do. Yet, the guys either ignored my interview requests on these stories or tried to kill them outright. Hillary, whose friends always said was the most famous person no one knows, didn't want to leave anything to chance. If she was going to reveal glimpses of her biography, it would be on her own terms. In the end, none of it mattered. I'd always tried to see Hillary and cover Hillary as a complete person, with black and white and lots of gray areas. But there was never any gray area in how Hillary saw me. No number of positive front-page stories could change her mind. And I understood why Hillary hated the Hampton story in particular. Mingling with the 0.001% looked terrible, but it was true. All of it. We'd hardly laid eyes on Hillary when we all unbuckled our seatbelts and poured into the aisle to watch her stride to the back of the plane. She walked past rows of Secret Service and staff to greet our rowdy rear cabin. Hillary was Labor Day casual in the cotton baby blue shirt with a wide collar like the one she'd worn to the Iowa State Fair. Brooklyn proposed Hillary have a barbecue with the travelers and our families before the inaugural flight, an easy way to butter us up before the general election. The idea never got past Huma. Not happening, she said. Hey, guys, welcome to the big plane. It's so exciting, Hillary said in a tone that communicated the excitement of a visit to the post office. I'm so happy to have all of you with me, she said, clutching her fists and stomping them up and down her torso like a toddler demanding a toy. I've been just waiting for this moment. She surveyed our blank stares and tried again. No, really, I wanted to welcome you onto the plane. I think it's pretty cool, don't you? No one said a word. You're supposed to say yes, Hillary said. A handful of us mumbled yes. I thought of the time in 2008 when Hillary stepped onto the bus in Des Moines bearing bagels and coffee that no one accepted. As much as I'd whined and pushed for a shared plane, by the time the Stronger Together Express arrived, we got the message. Hillary didn't want to finally get to know the women, plus Dan Marica, of her press corps. There would be no late nights gossiping off the record over a goblet of cheap wine. But with 2 months left, facing an opponent who ruled the airwaves, Hillary decided she needed us. Later that afternoon, Hillary assumed the position of a QVC host, walking back to the press quarters to display at chest height a copy of her new Stronger Together book, a collection of Clinton Kane policy proposals on sale in your local bookstore starting Tuesday for the bargain price of $15.99. Trump's 757 sat on the tarmac in Cleveland in a kind of high noon showdown with the peppy Stronger Together Express. I heard now that we've got this great plane that Donald Trump actually invited his press on his plane, where I'm told he even answered a few questions, Hillary said. So following my lead, as he just did, I would hope he continues and releases his tax returns. Part of a campaign reporter's job is allowing yourself to be used. At worst, we were captive stenographers, the tripods at the back of the gym. At best, we were the unruly conduits to the American people. The campaign must endure and accommodate us to get its daily message out, but I'd never felt more like a NY Times prestitute than on the inaugural Stronger Together flight. I started to think of myself as a secretary, valued by my employer mostly because of my ability to crank out 120 words per minute on my lap in a speeding motorcade. I'd record the audio of Hillary's rallies or press conferences, and, as we piled into the motorcade to get back on the plane and fly to the next swing state city, transcribe the quotes that fit the day's theme, i.e. Trump's taxes, Trump's treatment of women, Trump's bankruptcies. I'd type so fast that my cursor had a hard time keeping up and then send a feed to one of my colleagues in New York who wrote the main lead-all Franken story that day, which was almost always Trump-focused. Or I'd pull any Hillary news into a tight 800-word daily, the obligatory news stories that typically ran online or in the vitamin pages. I could write dailies half asleep while drinking red wine out of a plastic cup. 610 words, web only. Moline, Illinois. Hillary Clinton accused Russian intelligence of interfering with the American election, implying that President Vladimir V. Putin viewed a victory by Donald J. Trump as a destabilizing event that would weaken the United States and buttress Russian interests. Back in the newsroom, my Times colleagues made calls, pored over documents, and even got Trump's taxes in the mail. But the travelers, well, we were the yeomen of political journalists, shuttling between states to hear the same speech over and over and fighting over go-go in-flight wireless that was so temperamental that we'd started calling it no-go. But even on days when the canine crew that sniffed our luggage logged a more productive day's work than I did, I believe the trail was about more than seeing the country, or at least its high school gyms, being immortalized in a pile of front-page bylines and having some good stories to tell the kids. That was, if my fertile window hadn't closed. I was never one of those political reporters who, reared on a diet of all the president's men, held lofty notions about holding the powerful accountable and uncovering a scandal that leads to the toppling of an administration, international fame, and getting paid to blab on cable TV in perpetuity. That wasn't me. I just wanted to tell good stories that helped explain the world to people. In Japan, I started to see myself as a cultural anthropologist, using my reporting to demystify a culture that many American readers had reduced to a few geisha flicks and the atomic bomb. I had the same self-important notion when it came to Hillary. In minutes, over Katy Perry lyrics blared from scratchy speakers, I could weave into my stories references to Hillary's winning campaign for student government president at Wellesley, which the college paper called vague as to how exactly she would implement the change in the power structure. Her work on the children's health insurance program as